This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The tax man gets a bonus, companies that will pay employees to quit. And hashtag MyNYPD, how about hashtag YNYPD? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 23rd of April, and it's great to have you with us. Tax collectors are never popular, and our first story isn't going to change that. A U.S. government report shows that IRS employees received millions of dollars in bonuses, even though many of them were cited for things like drug use, fraudulent claims, or, wait for it, not paying their taxes. How'd that happen? How did IRS scofflaws get performance bonuses? We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to find out.
Assistant Inspector General Greg Kutz audited the IRS. He found that senior executives at the agency basically follow the rules, but it's a different story for more low-ranking workers.
The IRS has employees that have not paid their taxes, sometimes willfully and in an egregious manner. Yet not only are they still employed, but they're getting awards, and that's something that does seem to be inconsistent with IRS's mission of fairly administering the tax system.
He says the average bonus was around $1,000. Altogether, in 2011 and 2012, IRS employees with substantiated conduct issues received almost $3 million in bonuses. Under its contract with the union, the IRS can't use conduct issues when determining bonuses. Bonuses are tied strictly to performance. Is pay for performance a bad thing for federal employees?
No, I'm very much in favor of it. One of the problems of federal government is that they have a very rigid pay structure.
That's Andrew Biggs, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And though he generally believes that conduct outside of a person's job shouldn't impact bonuses, Biggs says the IRS situation is different.
It is difficult to have employees working for the IRS who didn't, in fact, pay their own tax. That undermines the credibility of the agency as a whole.
In a written statement, the IRS says it will consider a policy change, but in order to make conduct issues affect bonuses, the IRS must negotiate a new agreement with the National Treasury Employees Union. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The New York Police Department learned a lesson this week about social media. The NYPD asked the public to tweet photos of New Yorkers standing next to police officers with the hashtag MyNYPD. Well, to put it charitably, it took on a life of its own. New York's finest didn't get the meme they wanted, and now it's spread to Los Angeles and Chicago. Dan Bobkoff reports on hashtag hijacking. This wasn't the first time it's happened, and it probably won't be the last.
I'm sure it sounded like a good idea at the time, but this being both New York and social media, the NYPD didn't get quite what it expected.
Part of me is kind of incredulous. I mean, didn't they expect that they were going to get this kind of backlash?
Anne Hanley is a social media expert. What the NYPD got instead were scores of pictures of New Yorkers who appear to be abused, beaten, even run over by officers. Some of the photos may be old or misleading, but Hanley says the NYPD fell into a trap that has sunk many a social media campaign before it.
You know, you can't get people to talk about how great you are on Twitter.
The NYPD could have learned something from McDonald's experience 2 years ago.
Because people are sick of spin.
Howard Fensel of the crisis communications firm Hennis Painter says McDonald's wanted people to send in nice comments with the hashtag McD stories. But
the trolls came out of the woodwork with, you know, my brother found a faked fingernail in his French fries, hashtag McD stories.
Some companies have more success jumping into what everyone is already talking about on Twitter. After Colorado legalized marijuana, Ben & Jerry's got laughs tweeting a picture of empty ice cream shelves. But if you're big and important, the public just might be itching to knock you down a peg, says Jay Baer of the social media consultancy Convince and Convert.
The police department, McDonald's, right? So you talk about taking it to the man. not every organization is, quote unquote, the man.
Bayer says social media doesn't create hate, it just uncovers it. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Wall Street today, markets dip just a teeny bit. Details when we do the numbers. President Obama is in Japan, the first stop on a trip that'll take him to four countries in Asia. This is, I'll point out, the first state visit to Japan by an American president in almost two decades. It's part of what foreign policy types lovingly call America's pivot to Asia. The U.S. is hoping for stronger diplomatic and economic ties to the continent. Now, recently, Japan's been struggling with deflation, and that is the subject of today's edition of our series 25 for 25.
25 years.
25 things.
Jobs.
Revenue.
The economy.
The American people.
In honor of this, Marketplace's 25th year on the air, we're taking a look at 25 economic concepts. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour demystifies deflation, something economists fear both here and abroad.
To explain deflation and inflation, we are here at Precious Pets Doggy Daycare in Manhattan, where we can think of the economy as a small, puffy white dog.
This is a Jasper.
Also known as Econo Dog. And that is Econo Dog's trainer, Bernadette Ambrogioni. Now, when times are good, Econo Dog is plodding along and pulling us, the country, with him.
He likes to pull.
He likes to pull, especially at this corner, because he can go home.
And if he is pulling too hard, he might run off and roll in something nasty. Just like if the economy pulls too hard, you get inflation. So we have to pull back on his leash.
Econo Dog, I'm pulling you back now. You do not want to eat the pigeons and you do not want to eat those cigarette butts. Come back. Come back. Good boy. You're a good boy.
When the real economy is pulling too hard and driving up prices, we call that inflation. And the leash is interest rates. The Federal Reserve pulls on that leash by raising interest rates. It makes it harder for money to move too fast. But here is the problem with deflation. Deflation, that's falling prices, isn't caused by the economy growing too much. It's caused by growing too little. It's what happens when Econo Dog is at a standstill.
We need to go. I need you to go.
He doesn't want to. We stay here.
I mean, can I, like, shove the leash a little bit?
No, not really. I mean, if he doesn't want to go, he doesn't go.
And now he's just scratching himself. That's lovely.
You can't push with a leash, and neither can the Federal Reserve.
The way you typically try and stimulate an economy is you lower interest rates. But you can't lower interest rates below zero.
Justin Wolfers is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. After a point, interest rates, like a leash, only work in one direction. So how can we get Econo Dog to move?
We can pretend to go to his house.
So if we can change his expectations, if we can make him think that we're going to go to the place that he wants to go.
So if you want to try, I mean.
Econo Dog, it's time to go home. Do you want to go home? Oh, look, he's going. He's going.
Go, yeah.
Good boy.
There you go.
Now, I'm not kidding. Fighting deflation is very similar to this. Yes, you have to fix the underlying problem of a slow economy, but you also have to change people's minds.
Shifting expectations can be a great way of solving deflation.
If people expect deflation, they cause deflation.
When prices start to fall, people start to realize that it's better to spend money tomorrow when stuff is cheaper than spend money today. As a result, people start to spend less.
Spend less, the economy shrinks. Prices fall, and people spend less. It's a vicious cycle of stagnation.
Deflation leads to lower growth, leads to deflation, leads to lower growth, leads to deflation, leads to lower growth.
So you change people's expectations. You tell them you're printing money. You tell them you're going to create inflation. You're going to stimulate the economy.
If you can convince shopkeepers that you want to bring inflation back to the economy, then they'll expect that their competitors are going to raise their prices tomorrow. And therefore, there's no reason for me to cut my prices today.
And in a perfect world, people start spending today. Japan dealt with deflation for more than a decade and is still trying to fully exit that trap. Europe is straddling on the edge, and the U.S. is just 1 percentage point above deflation territory. Many economists are predicting we'll pull up just in time, but for now, the possibility is nipping at our heels. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The Hollywood talent agency William Morris Endeavor announced a big merger last December with the sports marketing firm IMG Worldwide. IMG represents NFL stars, NBA players, World Cup skiers, and baseball players with multi-million dollar contracts. The deal is scheduled to close in a few days, and Sharon Waxman, the founder of The Wrap, is here to tell us more about that gigantic deal. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, David.
Well, I wonder if you could just start by introducing us to two of these players here, William Morris Endeavor and IMG. Tell me just a bit about these two companies.
Well, William Morris Endeavor is in itself a young company because it's the result of a merger between the very venerable William Morris talent agency and a sort of young upstart talent agency in Hollywood called Endeavor. They're the second biggest talent agency in Hollywood, and they're very aware of their second place status to the, the big, giant number one, which is CAA, Creative Artists. They are a smaller company, William Morris Endeavor, but they will own IMG. But they've had to go out and raise $2.5 billion to finance this deal. And so this very ambitious acquisition of theirs, of IMG, which is the largest sports talent and events agency in the world, is very much the minnow swallowing the whale.
Well, let me ask you about that. So you got to look at some of the paperwork behind this deal, and I wanted to ask you what you learned from that. Among other things, it's that WME is going to carry or is carrying a lot of debt.
Once they do this financing thing, they're going to be carrying $2.5 billion in debt, which is an awful lot to service.
It's pretty sizable.
That's quite sizable. And, you know, these kind of leverage deals have gone on since the 80s, so it's not like they can't work, but they're risky. You know, they have to be driving a lot of cash flow to service that. The other issue here is what's interesting is that it really transforms the nature of WME, because what's really driving the bulk of their revenue will no longer be the talent representation business, which is what William Morris has always been associated with and been known for.
You know, I think a lot of people wonder what these companies do, and they think of an agency, they think of a talent agency. Just, you know, explain. It seems like a very or a decreasing amount of their business now is representing talent, representing actors or athletes, people like that.
Yeah, and that's because there's less and less money in representing actors, for sure. I wouldn't say that there's no money in representing sports talent. Those are very big licensing deals that happen. But both of those agencies have had to figure out other avenues to develop. On the CAA side, they've gone into sports. They also have a very big corporate business in terms of representing corporations and helping them make decisions around the entertainment business and branding business. So in general, the pie in Hollywood has shrunk. And so the talent agencies that are most closely associated with it have aggressively been developing different kinds of revenue streams. But this is a very big gambit on WME's part.
I wanted to ask you, lastly, you raised the specter of WME going public, and I wonder how radical that is. Are most of these companies private? Would it be a big deal if WME were to go public?
It's a break with tradition in a very big way. So what I'm hearing from inside the agency and also from people who are associated with IMG is that they're going to have to go public in order to fund the debt on this merger. That would be very interesting to watch. Who wants to buy those shares? Who wants to own a piece of a Hollywood talent agency? That's not been something that's been available to the investor public out there before.
Sharon Waxman is the founder of The Wrap. Thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, David.
Coming up, it was selected as America's Best in 1893. Pabst Blue Ribbon, the pride of Milwaukee.
It's right on the can. It's all over the website, all over the promotional materials. We've really made this beer what it is.
Trying to bring PBR back home to Milwaukee, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average took off 12 points, less than 0.1%, to wrap 16,501. The NASDAQ unplugged 34 points, 0.8%, to close at 4,126. And the S&P 500 fell 4 points, 0.2%, to 1,875. The Commerce Department says new home sales fell 15% in March. That's the worst level in almost a year. And airline earnings provided some positive tailwinds. Delta soared 6%. Boeing built a gain of 2.4%. Zynga announced after the bell that its founder, Mark Pincus, has stepped down as chief product officer. The social gaming company rose more than 4% in after-hours trading. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. Did you buy a dishwasher in March? The Commerce Department reports on orders for appliances and other durable goods. It's Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. Not a parent? Maybe it's get away from your coworkers' kids and take a really long lunch day. And the focus is on traveling far, really far. A 3-day Humans to Mars Summit wraps at George Washington University. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. A Canadian company called Valeant Pharmaceuticals International wants to look better, at least on paper. It's made an offer for Allergan, the manufacturer of Botox. That's not out of character for the company. Over the past couple of years, Valeant has bought up several pharmaceutical and healthcare outfits, the makers of creams and fillers, and also skin-smoothing lasers. But unlike some drug companies, Valeant is not looking to make more money by increasing research and design. Sally Herships fills in the rest.
You don't have to wrinkle up your forehead to figure out why Valeant wants to buy the company that produces Botox.
They are clearly going to have a monopoly in the marketplace.
Dr. Jack Birdie is CEO of SmoothMed, a service that provides Botox treatments in Manhattan. He says Valeant already bought the company that makes Dysport, a Botox competitor.
I can't imagine the company Valeant, who would look for economics in a takeover, maintaining both products in the marketplace. One of them will probably disappear.
Along with a lot of jobs. Seamus Fernandez is an analyst with Leerink Partners.
For some people, this is going to create stress and wrinkles.
That's a fair conclusion, yeah.
Fernandez says the international market for cosmetic dermatology is worth billions every year, and Valeant is trying to be efficient. David Krempa, an analyst with Morningstar, agrees.
Most doctors are pretty busy. They would much prefer to just talk to one person who can go through and update them on what's new about all the products they use, rather than having to have a bunch of different salespeople come in from each company.
Fernandez says, unlike the wrinkles it fixes, the market for cosmetic dermatology is growing at about 12% a year. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The beer Pabst Blue Ribbon has been around for more than a century. It was, as it says on the can, established in Milwaukee in 1844. But this past decade has been especially good for PBR. Sales in the last 10 years have gone up more than 200%. If you know someone who's between the ages of 21 and 35, odds are he drinks the stuff. And if he has a beard and wears flannel, the odds are even better. But I digress. The growth has led to a move from Milwaukee to Los Angeles, and now there's a movement among some Milwaukeeans to get their favorite beer back. WUWM's Latoya Dennis has the story.
Back in the day, Milwaukee was known as the beer capital of the world. But if there were ever a beer that truly represents the city, Susie Seidelman says Pabst Blue Ribbon is it.
Pabst is from Milwaukee. And so much of the brand's authenticity, its draw, its appeal, its marketing has to do with Milwaukee.
Seidelman is part of a Facebook group called Milwaukee Should Own Pabst Blue Ribbon. It has more than 4,000 members.
It's right on the can. It's all over the website, all over the promotional materials. We've really made this beer what it is.
Pabst might have been born in Milwaukee, but for the last 4 years, it's been headquartered in Los Angeles. It's owned by investor C. Dean Metropolis. He's the guy responsible for bringing Twinkies back. The Pabst brand is worth a lot of money, anywhere from $500 million to $1 billion. Seidelman says coming up with that kind of cash would take a lot of people willing to part with their money.
We would have the brewery be community owned. by the city of Milwaukee. We would put the call out to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of investors asking for small support in the form of purchase shares.
Local business owners like Jim Hurdle are rallying around the movement. He has a special interest in Pabst.
We have their former corporate offices. We have Captain Pabst's old office, even his roll-top desk, which we would gladly save for the president.
Hurdle says he had to fight to save many of the old industrial brick buildings at Pabst headquarters. He even opened a bar in one. He says he has space to accommodate the new Pabst if it comes back to Milwaukee.
Pabst is certainly the first of the great Milwaukee brewers. Schlitz would share some of that fame. The two of them really duked it out over the years.
But now Pabst owns Schlitz and Blatz and brands like Colt 45. And the company does all this without even brewing its own beer. It pays Miller Coors to do that. But Pabst does have one thing going for it.
Pabst is still the largest American-owned brewery.
Jim Kupfer-Schmitz owns the Milwaukee Beer Museum. He says that's because Miller Coors and Anheuser-Busch are both now owned by foreign beer makers. Kupfer-Schmitz says there's a good reason beer companies are buying out competitors.
You want as much shelf space on the liquor store and in the tavern as you can possibly get.
As for Milwaukee's push to bring Pabst back, Susie Seidelman says she knows it's a bit of a pipe dream, but she says it's not about the beer. In fact, she doesn't even drink Pabst.
I'm more of a Miller High Life person myself.
Seidelman says Pabst never should have left. She says it's about righting a wrong. In Milwaukee, I'm LaToya Dennis from Marketplace.
You had a rough day at work, and it's a Wednesday, so maybe you did. I've got a question for you, and that is, how much money would your boss have to pay you to quit? Well, Amazon has introduced what's called a pay-to-quit plan. CEO Jeff Bezos writes about it in his annual letter to Amazon shareholders. The online retailer says it'll give a few thousand dollars to full-time employees who want to walk. So here to explain why on earth Amazon would pay its employees to quit is Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, it's great to talk to you.
Great to be here.
So I read this in Amazon's letter to shareholders, and I think, all right, good job, Amazon. That's a pretty good gimmick. But tell me, is it something more than that?
It certainly is something more than that in the originating company. So Jeff Bezos takes this idea from Tony Hsieh, the founder of Zappos, which Amazon now owns. And it's worked quite well at Zappos on the grounds that you create a customer-centric group of people that understand what they're doing there, why they're doing it, and have, in some sense, crossed the Rubicon of saying, I could have left, but I didn't.
Who's the worker that Amazon does want to take this offer?
You know, by the way, it only applies to full-time workers. So they want disgruntled or doubting Thomas kind of person to take the money and walk out the door. And, you know, there's a financial argument here. There's an argument about, you know, what does it cost to get rid of people that turn out to be bad fits? Well, it can be enormously expensive. I think it is as much a financial and strategic issue as it is an image or PR issue.
Our eyes are drawn to the numbers here, $2,000, $5,000. You know, that's what attracts our attention. But you're saying in the grand scheme of things, those numbers aren't that big.
They aren't that big. And you can just think about one employee that decides to file a lawsuit, and that $5,000 is a gnat's eyelash piled up against that.
I think of just sort of where we are now in terms of the broader national economy. You have so many people who are looking for work, and this is probably not that high on the list for a lot of people. They would just like to have a job. Would you agree with that?
You know, I do. I think that this is this kind of, if you will, initiative or this kind of, you know, policy is something for companies that, you know, that have a big and growing workforce. Both Zappos and Amazon are growing, right? That's a very different position, right, than either a company that's shedding workers or refusing to hire because they don't want to commit those resources given an uncertain economy. You know, this is in some sense, you know, a great, if you will, kind of issue to be able to broach, but it is by no means the bread and butter issue, I think, for many companies and many, many workers.
Do you think that this will catch on? You have it happening with Zappos. You have it happening with Amazon. Do you think that other companies are going to take notice, that they're going to try plan of their own out like this?
You know, this is getting an awful lot of attention, but I do not think it's getting a lot of attention because we're going to see lots of copycats. I think companies that really invest in their culture and the people and how people fit in that culture are already doing all kinds of things to keep people engaged and to ferret out the folks that aren't so engaged. Companies that don't care very much about culture or just aren't prepared to pony up a lot of resources behind it are going to, you know, say, interesting idea. You know, I'm glad Bezos has the money and the team to roll this out, but so not for me.
Nancy Kane's an historian at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today about one James Edward Franco, an actor, yes, but also a poet, a novelist, a filmmaker, and an artist. Well, not so fast, says Roberta Smith, co-chief art critic for the New York Times. Some of Franco's photographs are on display at a gallery in New York, and Smith is not impressed. Franco remains, quote, embarrassingly clueless when it comes to art, she writes in her review. The deep content here beneath the entitled narcissism is a confused desperation that seems to drive Mr. Franco's pursuit of visual art. She continues, and so do I. It's hard not to feel some sympathy for him while also wishing that someone or something would make him stop. Ouch. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Some notable tech profit reports to tell you about today. After the markets closed, both Facebook and Apple surprised investors with strong revenues. Facebook reported that its revenue jumped 72% during the past 3 months, thanks to mobile ads. And Apple said it sold 43.7 million iPhones in the past 3 months, and it's going to buy back more stock. Shares in both companies were up in after-hours trading. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. Douglas Bell helped us out in D.C. I'm David Gura. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.